That's why I'm all in bed. Nobody gives me sympathy.
Hello, and welcome back to our podcast, a fanfic of a fanfic that itself is a synthesis of Fallout, the popular game of post-apocalyptic wasteland, and My Little Pony, a popular show about pastel horses. I didn't screw it up this time. I'm joined again once again with my host, Weird. Say hello, Weird.
Well, you did mess up one thing. The proper title is Sir Weirdington Esquire. And I'm not entirely certain you introduced yourself. Fi, dear co-host, always forgets my full, rightful title that I bestowed upon myself by my own divine right.
Okay, hey folks, we're back again. We're season two now. Season two, same as season one. More podcasting, more recording, more inane reading out of a story, more yelling about capitalism. We're back and better.
But this time
than
with I think a better understanding of the grim framework of the tale before us. That truly we are dealing with a world full of pastel horses, in the land that friendship forgot.
I love that line. I think that's my favorite thing to come out of this so far. So Weird, tell us what we learned last week, then.
So the broad points of last episode, or just an overall, like as fast as I can, synopsis of the story so far.
I think we should just go with what happened last chapter. If people want to like listen to our ramblings about the episode in review, just go back and listen to last episode again. We covered it pretty thoroughly.
That's a shame because I can't remember. Oh wait, okay, so it was just a giant battle set piece, mostly.
Yeah, it's a big. It was a big wherein, like, Old West gunfight.
Yeah, every faction that we'd encountered thus far shows up all at once in no particular order of introduction to come kill Blackjack, including pony versions of the ghost twins from the second Matrix movie. I think that was the second Matrix movie.
Mm-hmm.
Phasing ghost twins. Dr. Professor Scientist's sibling, final confrontation with Deus, Immortan Pone, also known as.
Mm-hmm.
We find out that her name is Carnage.
Rampage. It might as well be Carnage.
Because she's pure 90s.
She is pure 90s.
She has like the Burger King like kids club mascot like from 95 on her flank as her cutie mark, like just the like 90 like on a garish background of like,
yeah, it's pastel color. It's bright pink, it's neon pink and green and a skateboard. That's what her cutie mark is. How do you do, fellow ponies?
Whatever her name is in the text, whatever Somber wants us to think her name is, she's Horse Pool.
Mm-hmm.
We discover entirely. Let's see. A lot of like hilariously random exposition breaks in the middle of this massive like across town shootout that presumably never amount to anything. Finally concluding in a ghost pony inserting a bomb underneath Deus's plating, and I will not accept any other interpretation of the text that
because
I haven't actually
dumb.
Read.
Because it's dumb that it isn't that.
Because, like, funny thing about armor, it deflects, like, external.
Otherwise, like, when he blew up, he basically blew up like a pressure cooker.
Which would explain the devastating results of his exploding.
Mm-hmm.
More if it was internal, it'd be so much worse for him. Like if the armor was that super tech, supernaturally good, then and like it'd be almost impossible for the blast to escape, causing like a pressure cooker. Vaguely, he has some sort of last words or something. Anyway, so with that major threat, first big boss monster down, meaningful like built up threat, put down. Blackjack offers P-21 the opportunity to kill her, and P-21 says, "You're so virtuous and noble because you did the bare minimum."
You tried.
I mean, try might actually be a little bit too generous based on, like, the description that you gave me of, like, what... Oh, right, yeah, no, of you actually gave me the actual text, and, like, basically it sums up, like, he is literally doing the, like... There is a popular meme that is really excellent at pointing out the, like, you could have been so much worse award. Like,
mm-hmm. You didn't suck as bad as you could have.
And that is justification enough to, like, really, like, call out, like, well, you've really opened my eyes to, like, how, like, you were such a, like, you've taken such a hard road by not being, like, infinitely craven.
You might have forced yourself on me and killed my only lover in Stable 99, but you're good at heart. You're doing your best. You're trying. And that's the respectable part.
I don't know why I didn't rail in on it harder last episode, but it over the last week has really occurred to me the, like, hard road. You've taken the hard road by not, like, chickening out and being, like, as craven as you could possibly be. Like, goddamn, like... Maybe I just have an outsized moral standard personally, because I'm the sort of person who, like, relishes games that don't have, like, a the hard mode is the morally good mode, the, like, zero kills, like, there's no button that, like, turns the game into easy mode. Easy mode is killing everyone. Hard mode is going to extreme lengths to spare the lives of people killing you, mm-hmm. trying to kill you. Like, she's not that. It's really impossible to say that, like, Blackjack, as depicted in the story, is even good at heart, because in an earlier chapter, she's very excited for the opportunity to be morally justified in killing someone.
It lets her LARP her fantasy of being a good person.
She is a gun at heart.
She is a gun at heart.
Anyway, yeah, no. So we learn that moral virtue is defined by the capacity to do the bare minimum.
Yeah, meaning it well.
It is very specifically in air quotes. Like there are two morals. There's a very thick moral gradient in this world. Means well. Air quotes, and pure evil.
Yeah. I guess that gives us an opportunity to launch into our next chapter then, though, with that sour note. So, chapter 17, identity. Oh, whoop, almost forgot. We had a perk last week that I should go over. It's nothing too major, since it's only a one-chapter perk, but she gains, because of all the rough-and-tumble shooting, she gains the perk Action Mare, which allows her to use her SATS skills more effectively, her like auto targeting murder, which I've kind of like exempted for the story for like, because like I'm a nice person and you don't need to hear every single time she like slips into bullet time mode and caps somebody in a horrible gratuitous manner, but like she now could do that more often, so good for her.
Great.
But anyways, chapter 17, identity. So we open up with this chapter with BJ having, like, a bizarre, like, Ship of Theseus moment, where she's like, am I even the same person as the person who left the stable? Like, she rambles off all of her kind of experiences she's seen so far, and, like, how much she feels like she's changed over the course of the story, and can she still count herself as Blackjack? And while it's kind of bullshit and nonsensical, it does set up our theme of our chapter, which is about, like, the presumption of names and identity is kind of the theme of this whole chapter, which, I mean, like, is actually cool that, like, Somber included a theme in a chapter for once.
Good on him.
I'm trying to be positive. I can't always shit on the guy.
No, 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 that's perfectly fine. Like, if he's gonna learn any lesson from, like, the original Pony series, like, might as well be writing 101, like, shit.
Yeah. I think it's also important to denote that, like, contrast is somewhat required with this stuff, because when we get to a lot of the bullshit, it'll be staggering, because it because it's not like it's a failure to communicate ideas or a failing to have basic writing form. It's just that the author has insidious fucking opinions about things. So that I think that's part of the reason why I'm making so much effort to try this point this out, and also not to just sound like a nitpicky CinemaSins ding 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 asshole. Anyways, we open up after her having her little ship of Theseus moment with like the characters kind of having a big cool off from the previous chapter. Everyone's trying to like put shit back together and flank, and they like loot the bodies for gear. BJ gets a cool sniper rifle off of one of the bounty hunters that tried to kill you, so that's neat. We get another bizarre metaphorical hallucination card game with poker skeleton that doesn't really amount to anything outside of just, like, more... Like, it's more, like, beating you over the head with metaphor that's unnecessary.
Once again, a skeleton makes fun of her.
Yeah, like, it's her playing cards, and all the cards have metaphorical meanings, and they all prescribe different things in the story, but, like, it's nothing we haven't seen before, it's nothing new, so it's just, it really is just a skeleton making fun of her again. oh boy, I get to have another part where I read out a section in full, because I got so mad at this part. So, we have another incredibly disappointing conversation with Glory. I need to vamp for like 2 seconds to get to the point in the chapter because I don't have it queued up. Because they basically have the back and forth where Glory is like, I need to change my name because I can't, like, people can't know that I'm still around as a Dashite because it'll disgrace my entire family. And she has a big, giant family that all depend on like the Enclave to survive because they're all like part of the system in one way or another. But like, Christ, there's this line. BJ says, "How can you do that? How can the Enclave betray you, but be so hard on Pegasi, strong enough to walk? This doesn't make any sense. So hard on Pegasi, strong enough to walk away from that." And then she responds, "Walking away isn't strong." She snapped back at me, "Sticking it out, backing your fellow Pegasi, doing what must be done. That's strength," she said firmly. "The Enclave didn't betray me. Lighthooves did. And every single time some Pegasi goes Dashite, they completely destroy everything Rainbow wanted to do. Like they decided to drop her loyalty and courage and become the greatest egoists of the Pegasi." That is... that is some fucked up shit. This entire line of thinking is made of red flags. It's actually nuts. Like, specifically the line, "the greatest egoist of the Pegasi," chiefly reminds me eerily similar to a lot of how the center seems to view the left. Is what it reminds me a lot of. It's like, "Oh, well, you arrogant folk that want to just disrupt the system. We can't disrupt the system. We have to change it from the inside. It's arrogant to presume that things have to be changed without. They have to be changed within. We have to work within the rules." Oh, man, this character's the worst. I literally wrote a point of, like, why are you like this? Like, why are you like this, Glory? Like, there's a later part where she defends slavery. Like, I forgot that, like, Glory is a... Like, she's not even just kind of a neo-lib. She's, like... She's meant to be... Because, like... So, to go on afterwards, this is a really bad retelling of the story of Deadshot Calamity. But she then says, "There was once a few years back a real high-profile case. Deadshot Calamity, a legend in the security forces. The kind of pony who could have really forced the council to engage with the surface. He gets an audience in front of the Pegasi Council. Does he call for opening contact with the surface? No. Does he say we should trade food and medicine to the surface? No. Said he spends half an hour calling the entire council cowards, feather brains, and negligent murderers. Then when his wing went looking for him to beg him to reconsider, he killed them, which is not true. That's a total lie and fabrication. Somber made a bunch of that shit up. Specifically, the wing they went to go kill him because he was dissenting against the council in a public forum."
I mean, that would be the evil government's retelling of, like, that's how they would frame the deaths of the goon squad. It's easy to give Somber the benefit of the doubt in this case of, like, just of writing the perspective of a deeply, like, indoctrinated doof. like writing the perspective of a fool who is totally bought into the party line.
Yeah. But, like, as someone who can see into the future, like I can, and know how this plays out, when we get to the Enclave DLC of the story, it's really weirdly light on huge members of the military. Like, it prescribes the idea that there are, like, those that want to coup because they want things to, like, stay the status quo. But there's also a whole bunch of secretly good people that have just been waiting for the right opportunity for to do good. And it kind of presents, like, the area that specifically Glory is from is a bunch of, like, mewling libs that are, like, not trying hard enough. And because they're pacifistic, they're going to basically be wiped out by the stronger, harder fought arm of the Enclave. Like, it's one of those things where, like, in a vacuum, like, you can almost say this is a commentary, but, like, whoopsie doodle, he can't help but, like, also jack off to the Enclave.
Friend, enemy, distinction.
Yep.
The, like, cult of action. Mm-hmm. Might as well, like, fucking have Umberto Eco's 14 characteristics on hand at all time while listening to this story so we can play bingo.
You can play fascism bingo. Because, like, I don't know, like, I also, like, just to talk about it for a brief second in this particular chapter and then and in later parts, one of the things I hate about Somber's retelling of the Enclave is that in FOE, the Enclave are presented as a particularly strong force right up until anyone actually challenges them, and they're proved to be hilariously inept. Because as it turns out, just because they have a bunch of guns and technology doesn't mean they actually know fuck all about how to wage war against the surface, and the surface, which are really relatively used to, like, essentially engaging in guerrilla tactics. Yeah, an endless conflict. Just clown them the entire time. Fucking, like, Little Pip and her crew just bust into one of their military organizations and steal a tank because they just assume that no one could possibly get into their facility. It's fucking hilarious.
And kind of true to life for that sort of thing. Like,
yeah.
Like, you do get paper tigers like that in reality.
Yeah. The American has a hilarious era of, like, oh, we're just going to send guns and men. Oh, whoops. We got clowned on by, like, superior tactics.
People who know the terrain.
But yeah, it's a frustrating thing that, like, the sort of, like, revisionism that the Enclave get in PH because of an effort to try and, like, make them more complex ends up making, like, their fascistic identity more palatable because it presents them as, like, the hard pill. Like, they're like, oh, well, things are bad, but of course they are. Like, everything's bad and you have to make these sacrifices to maintain order. When, like, FOE is just like, no, that they're idiots and they don't know it. Like, they get clowned on by, like, a fucking ragtag multicultural crew of idiots, like a dragon and a mouse. Like it's fucking ridiculous. But anyways.
Man, like, Pony Woody Guthrie, like, deserves better, like, than this slander.
This horse kills fascists. I love Calamity so much. Like, I feel like if I go back and read FOE, Calamity isn't going to be nearly as cool, but, like, the Calamity...
That's why I'm not going to read FOE. Like Pony, like, flying horse Woody Guthrie, like, will always remain, like, pure in my heart.
Like, as far as I remember, he still is basically that. It's just that, like, there are missteps because the author is not a terribly fantastic writer, but, like, consistently Deadshot is, like, or Calamity, sorry, is, like, the voice of reason in a lot of situations. Like, he's the voice, like, his, like, again, his big catchphrase, or not catchphrase, but, like, one of his big points is you can't fix dead. Like, you can't unkill people. So, like, you have to be very cautious about, like, who you actually choose to, like, kill in this wasteland.
Also, like, I imagine she's not called out for her, like, doth protest too much, like, hypocrisy that, like, walking away isn't brave. Didn't you do precisely that when you, like, refused to continue working on, like, the genocide bomb? Like, the aerosol zombie plague that you were helping to develop?
Well, it's because no one actually, like... I think Samba just kind of drops that plot point because no one seems to ever address it. Because, of course, they don't. These characters are uncomplicated. They're not nearly as deep as Samba likes to pretend they are.
All right, so
yeah, we should
spend a lot of time on that.
Oh, we could go on for I could go on forever about the Enclave.
Oh, no doubt. That's why
we got to spearhead this back to like reality. But anyways, Glory decides to drop her name, and now she's called Fallen Glory instead of Morning Glory.
Fuck you.
Yeah, it's an incredibly lame one.
What? Okay. Hey. All right. So, what do we call you, Glory? Yeah. No one's gonna trace that shit back. No one will suspect.
No one will suspect that I, Fallen Glory, was Morning Glory the whole time.
This story is dumb.
But she kind of has a cry over her fucked up situation, which admittedly is pretty rough. Like as fucked up and bullshit it is as a character, like as a story, it is kind of fucked up that she got like burned for no reason.
No, I'm callous. I know. Like fucking worked on like a aerosol zombie plague and like refused to own that. And now you're making apologies for your fucking Nazi home country and like all of their worst impulses.
I can never go back to the Luftwaffe ever again. How will I go on? Oh boy, I don't know how you're gonna take this though. So in a moment of like BJ trying to make Glory feel better, BJ reveals her comically dark secret. Like it's not actually a dark secret, but she's leaning to it as a joke. So it's revealed. It's actually been revealed in a couple of other parts, but like it's never really been like openly stated by the protagonist. Blackjack is not her actual name. She decided to change her name when she got a cutie mark as a blackjack. Her name is actually Go Fish, but she decided to drop that years ago, apparently. This is not really a interesting plot point, but I kind of just love the idea that, like, her name is, like, a kind of a gag, and it's like, no, I want to be a cool character, I want to be Blackjack. And even this plot point is fucked up, because there's a later part where they have to, like, figure out if she... They do the name test thing of like, you know, okay, I don't know who to shoot between these two people who look identical. And she goes, oh yeah, my name's Go Fish. And that should immediately trip people because that's the whole point of this kind of naming convention thing. And they fucks it up because he's trying to be subversive. It's like, fuck you, Somber. It's such a stupid way to handle this thing. Like, you set up this Chekhov gun like fucking in chapter 17 and pay it off in the stupidest way. Like, I don't know. This is me rambling on like a point that I've been wanting to complain about for years.
Her cutie mark is two cards. What are they again?
It's a blackjack. It's a queen and an ace.
Okay. Yeah, I seem to remember like whining that it should have been an ace and an eight. If you're gonna be cool, like if your whole goddamn story is gonna be cool and dark and edgy, like
you might
why
as well
the hell
go
in your like
yeah, go for the dead man's
aces
hand.
And eights. Like yeah. Shit.
Well, it's supposed to be the gag of like all of the security head forces have all had like card names, which are only the only real important ones to know are Card Trick, Flush, and her mother, which is Gin Rummy. No, not Flush. Card Trick, Tarot, Gin Rummy, and Blackjack, which is actually Go Fish. But yeah, it's a character moment. It's meant to make her seem softer than BJ often is, but like it's stupid and pointless. It also brings in a lot of weird questions. If like, it presents the idea that names aren't necessarily prescriptive in this setting. Like they're not. It's not like what do you call it? Nominative predestiny or whatever. But like that meant like Daisy and Marmalade like kept their names as Daisy and Marmalade despite the fact that like they clearly didn't have cutie marks that related to that, or like their roles in society weren't like being a florist and they like I don't know. You call it. There's a term for people who make jars of stuff.
Mason is the only thing that comes to mind.
Yeah, like a masoner or something jar. Like that.
Also, like, oh shit, like if like if names aren't, like, prescriptive, as they are in, like, the original show, and it's just not explained and there's no reason to explain it, then, like, what sort of, like, contempt do you have for your infant? Like, you're, like, you produce a foal, and, this one's probably not going to work out. What do we call it? Go Fish, I guess? Like, because not only is Go Fish, like, the name of, like, the worst card game, the baby's card game, it's also the description of a failure state in that game.
Yeah. It's because Blackjack is basic, and she's also a fail son, so I guess it's, like, sort of fitting. It's more fitting to her character, I suppose.
All right, so we have... Doctor of the Fallen has been rechristened.
Yeah, and we've got Security Horse, Go Fish.
I'm Blackjack. And this is my friend 21, and this is I'm Doctor the Fallen.
I'm Doctor Evil. Okay. I guess we should move on. As much as I would like to just laugh about Glory's stupid name change.
Let us spend another half hour contemplating a girl with a sweet southern accent trying to be goth as heck.
That would be almost
my
endearing.
My soul knows nothing but the grimness and despair of betrayal of my glorious homeland.
That would almost be endearing if she wasn't a fash. But we do get my favorite, like, scene aesthetically, maybe in this whole story, where we hard cut to another scene where, like, the whole town is kind of getting back to working order, because everyone's getting out of the stable, which they were using as a fallout shelter, basically, for the attack. And they find that BJ is tits drunk in a full bathtub, still in her clothes, drunkenly singing, which is maybe my favorite, like, mood aesthetic of Blackjack. It's I think it's the thing that charmed me of the character, is just, like, this drunken idiot completely clothed in a bathtub in the middle of the street, singing show tunes. And drunkenly arguing with 21. It's maybe the most fun the character ever has in the whole story. But she drunkenly has a conversation with 21 about the nature of names, because that's the whole theme of this chapter, right? Where he's like, well, you know, you're at a stable 99 now. Like, are you going to call yourself anything besides 21? And he kind of makes the dumb decision of just like, nah, I want to carry stable 99 with me for the rest of my life, apparently. So, like, 9 is, like, I'm just gonna call myself 21, like, indefinitely.
Just keep that wound open.
Yep.
Never let that trauma scab.
Yep. It's also that way we can have Blackjack and 21 be our main characters.
Yeah, that occurred to me a little while ago, but I
didn't want to say anything about it because it's
declined to mention it.
It's mega stupid.
Very, yes. A lot stupid.
It's that way our entire story can be about the protagonist, like the deuteragonists of Blackjack and 21, which are male and female mirrors of each other, sort of, which is stupid and not like anything.
I don't see it.
Yeah.
I don't see it.
Yeah, I don't see it either. I'm reading it and I don't see it, outside of knowing that, like, this is the kind of sort of metaphor Zomber would put in his story. Anyways, we hard cut to
such a wunderkind, this Somber.
He could do anything except write anything any worth a damn. But yeah, BJ, we hard cut to BJ waking up with a hangover. We're just gonna go fast through a bunch of scenes. BJ wakes up, goes to a bar, drinks a hangover cure, which is very disgusting. But she apparently has, like, no sense of taste and drinks a couple of them. Everyone's like shocked that she can drink multiple of these hangover cures. Then she has a discussion with the bar pony and the rest of the crew about tightening up security in flank, because she's convinced that, like, that the fight wouldn't even have happened. Like, they wouldn't even have dared bust into flank if they had proper security. And she manages to rope the rest of her gang into it by sweet talking the idea of, like, Glory, you'll get to build turret robots, and 21, you'll get to set up landmines. And they're kind of like, ooh, things for us to actually do in the story. But the conversation goes a little askew because Bar Pony starts kind of getting nervous about all of this, like, security talk and kind of insinuates that, like, you know, you guys, didn't you guys have something to do? Didn't you have, like, to talk to Caprice and get your, like, get all your caps cashed in? But BJ keeps persisting that Caprice is, A, still gone, and if she had actually bothered doing anything, then this wouldn't even be a problem in the first place. And so everyone starts giving her weird looks about like, mentioning Caprice so much. But before they can tell her who, like, before they can reveal the identity of who Caprice actually is, BJ, conveniently vomits up her hangover cure, and then she gets told to, like, freshen herself up in the stable in one of the rooms. This is when the story becomes a shitty sitcom where everyone besides Blackjack knows the identity of Caprice, and even the audience can obviously clue in on who it is. The story refuses to tell her, and every time she asks, everyone has a new excuse for why they can't just explain to her who it is, which will get infuriating at the end of this chapter. We shall press on. Hangs out in the hotel room. She takes a shower and gets cleaned up. And she spends some time waxing about home because she's now in a stable bed and talking about how all stable beds are basically the same and how she misses home again. She mentions about Flank being a potential force for good because despite the hedonistic tone of it, it's still positive because it's one of the very few joys that the Waste has to offer is sex, drugs, and rock and roll basically. Then she finds a memory orb in the hotel room, which she can't help herself from using it. Yay, memory orbs, the thing I love the most in this story.
Of course.
We have this was a scene that was I struggled to read through because it was so fucking boring. But we have this incredibly tedious political scene, which I think is meant to, be some sort of biting criticism, but it falls pretty flat. It's a long conversation where, the leaders of the government, which are the princesses, are having arguments with the aristocrats who want to try and, maintain their, capitalistic ventures in the Zebra Lands. And there's a lot of, very libertarian scoffing at government that's like, well, why don't you just do this? It would solve it instantly. There's a part where they're like, we need the coal the zebras have, and they've stalled on the trade deals because of this catastrophe that happened. And one of them, one of them is just like, what, Luna specifically, one of the princesses, is like, why did we ever bother setting up our infrastructure based off coal? And it's like one of those things where it's like, oh yeah, just like, why do we use oil? We could just use a different power source. And it's like, because that's not how governments or commerce or capitalism works, you dumb shit. Let's just use a different power source that we're not beholden to use because of the vested interest of the corporations that control our country. But it's also just a part to have Goldenblood show up and defeat the aristocrats with logic and reason, because they keep insisting on war, and he's just like, well, you can't go to war. We can just defuse this. It's just that you can't because you don't understand zebra culture like I do. I have vested knowledge in zebra culture, and I know that they can't go to war with you. And we get into some really creepy colonial Africanization kind of issues with the way that zebras are treated in this, where it's like, oh, well, their king is not a king. He's a protector, and he's beholden to protect his people, which just reeks of a lot of bizarre exoticism of ulterior cultures. Oh yeah, they're beholden to traditions we can't possibly understand, so you have to comply with them, but they can't compromise on theirs, but we have to compromise on ours. And it's like a very it reeks a lot of the kind of excuses colonialism uses to why they had to exterminate people the native tribes, because the native tribes won't listen to them, with air quotes.
They sleep in chairs and eat only raw food.
Yes, clearly they must be exterminated as the savages they are. But it's really just an excuse to make Goldenblood seem even cooler than he already is. Because even as a small child, he understood politics better than all of the supposed aristocrat adults. This is first year political science guy, believing that he can just fix it with some libertarian politics.
I'm a rational big boy and in no way a self-insert.
Yeah, I'm a big brain thinky boy. We then cut to the next day, because apparently nothing came of her being in that hotel room. We cut to the next day after with BJ. shit. So she manages to convince the security force at Flank to like get some lessons under her, which is so we like kind of fast cut past her already trying to train them, and she's like a disgruntled drill sergeant about it, or she's like, well, they're good kids, but they don't pick up what I'm trying to teach them. And it's really just an excuse for having a conversation with her and Bar Horse, kind of talking about the idea of like security in Flank. And Bar Horse starts flirting with her along the way while this is happening. There is a incredibly hilariously tone-deaf line that comes out of this where BJ's like, I want to treat them right, train them right, because I want them to have discipline, because the only difference between like them and a thug with a gut with a uniform is discipline, which is hilariously tone deaf about police. Hilarious.
Well, I mean, also, what the fuck would she know about what these people like need to be trained in? Because they need to be trained to like handle like outside threats. She was like, she got her position, she's very clearly established to have gotten her position in the, like, security force back home through pure nepotism. And what exactly did, like, her small town, like, sheriff experience teach her that, like, these city cops need to know? Like, this is a large settlement with a lot of recurring outside threats versus her small town that was utterly isolated. Like her sole experience as a cop is bullying locals into not questioning the Soylent Green program.
Like, yeah, she was small town Gestapo. Like she, what the fuck does she know about anything? Like it's also clashes with her general fail son like existence as well. Like she wasn't a good cop. Like what does she know about like passing on cop tutelage to others? But she spends a while moralizing the idea of like police force, and she talks in a bunch of big broad platitudes about like the good of protection and helping people, and is then interrupted by the Bar Horse giving her a long impassioned kiss.
Yeah, she's seriously making an argument for a mafia, like like mafia soldiers like can be pretty damn disciplined. Like anyway, sorry.
Yeah. No, you're totally right. Like, yeah, she's basically... Because it's also important to remember that Flank is a town of drug dealers. Like, she is teaching...
their fucking enforcement is probably pretty on point. Like, if this story were told with any sincerity and any thought, then, like, these people being trained by her would be, like... laughing their asses off, like... Like every time she turns her head, like these people don't know how to like enforce the peace, how to like
they don't know anything about breaking kneecaps, like like it's really surreal when you take a step back. It's basically like it's basically as if like a skinhead walked up to a bunch of like mobsters and be like, "Here, I'm gonna teach you how to be cops." Oh Christ. Oh man. So fuck. That threw me off rails real fast. Anyways, BJ is interrupted with her platitudes by Bar Horse giving her a long, intense, passionate kiss, which is described in detail, much like the murder scenes are. And she sort of like half mentions that she would regret not doing that. And then she kind of like makes some bedroom eyes, and it's a come hither stare, and then we're kind of like led into the next scene on the promise that BJ is going to finally get some sexy times with another living, breathing horse. I literally just wrote a note to myself that just says "fucking happens," and I'm laughing at my own jokes again, because thankfully like Somber has the restraint to not like write it in detail, but we get the kind of afterglow. Pillow talk sort of scene after that sort of thing happens. BJ is chided weirdly for being very virginal, which is another one of those moments of like, did like Somber forget that his like protagonist is like a promiscuous cop character who like has like had a number of partners, despite being like kind of a disaster about it, like she has. Like, it's one of those really bizarre moments. Like, they don't even make like a a half attempt at like the oh it's been a while, so that's I'm out of practice kind of thing. It really hammers down the idea that she's like explicitly virginal and inexperienced, which is like just like a really weird like line of I've always talked about this, and it's like it's a weird thing to kind of dance around as an idea, but like sex is used a lot in a story as kind of like a metaphor for character's capacity. And BJ is weirdly virginal and inexperienced, and it's to contribute to her fail son nature, which like Somber doesn't understand what a bottom is, I guess is the point. And so just confuses it with someone who's just like inexperienced.
Sounds like a likely enough theory.
It's been my going theory, like is that like Somber just doesn't understand a queer character at all. Like at the very start of the story, I got mad at it because like her like BJ's sexuality is really vestigially like queer because like she's she makes kind of like an off mention like I don't know, I kind of like fuck women, I guess, and like it doesn't own that concept. Like it's not she's not presented or she's not coded as bi, she's just like conveniently lesbian as it's necessary, which is bullshit. And like I don't accept the character as being such. Like I don't care for Somber's terrible like LGBT like representation shit. Like he's just terrible at it. So as far as I'm concerned, BJ is a like promiscuous bisexual polyamorous like nut job, and like that's fine. I respect her wishes. But Somber is shitty at writing that character. So we get bizarre scenes like this where she's like promiscuous and bi, but also weirdly like incompetent at sex entirely.
Yeah, I mean, based on everything else that seems very strongly to be true of Somber's politics, they seem like a real sex haver, that Somber, real literate with direct experience in the subject.
But I'll get into it in later parts of this. But like Somber has the audacity, at least in his Patreon, to like describe himself as someone who makes LGBT characters, and like, is this what he means? Because if he does, he doesn't know what a bi person is. He doesn't understand anything about sexuality at all.
A real man of the world, true Don Juan, that Somber. Wait a minute, which one's the rapist, Don Juan or Casanova? I know that one is actually like,
oh man,
one of the two is like sort of gross.
Yeah, I don't remember which one is. Anyways, to prattle on more with this chapter. BJ then like leaves Bar Horse and gets into a tiff with Glory, who's kind of like weird and about her having random casual sex. Because of course she is, as a fash horse. But she does actually weirdly cognizantly call out the fact that like BJ's like, oh, we're doing good for Flank. We're making it a better place. And Glory's like, we're helping drug dealers be better at being drug dealers, BJ. Like, I can't possibly believe that single factory had a total monopoly over like the drug trade. And now Caprice has like a monopoly on it. And BJ retorts with the shitty opinion of, well, she's keeping the prices high. She's the people can't get she can't help too many users. And weirdly, in a moment of actual understanding of capitalism, Glory says, yeah, but she can always just reduce the prices and undercut all the other dealers whenever she needs to, because she's in a better position to do so. And that is a weird moment of clarity coming from Somber about capitalism. But anyways, that gets abruptly stopped by the fact that Glory is also a beta and is incapable of fighting, like actually arguing with BJ in any real way. So she instead just goes along with it because she has to. BJ decides to deliver some mail because that was one of the other quests she took, which was delivering mail to like dead people for some reason. I don't understand why this pays money. And convinces Glory to get parts for the turrets that they're making by going to a robot store. She delivers mail to the dead musician horse from the previous chapter and reads her mail, which is just basically her talking about the idea that she's under watch from the Ministry of Morale and basically contributing more to the idea that she's been blacklisted like communists were in the McCarthy era. Finds musician horses still working. I don't know if it's a cello or contrabass. It's like a giant like musical instrument. It's one of those ones you have to like put on a stand to be able to play. But turns out that BJ can somehow play a decent tune on the instrument, which is just a neat little skill I guess BJ has. This would be an interesting idea because it presents the idea that BJ maybe has skills that are like not killing people. And it deals with this a bit more, the idea that maybe like maybe cutie marks are a mistake and maybe like you can have more skills than just like the one thing prescribed to you. But this is quickly abandoned when we find out that the instrument is just magic and it just allows people to play it as an instrument better than they normally could. Kind of just
great.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, hey, you had this one interesting idea and like,
but also like it would lead into like how like magic armband or not, like how does a specialization at card games make for a particularly talented murderer?
Like, yeah.
Make for somebody who is at heart a gun.
Yeah.
Who down to at their very soul is a weapon.
Yeah, and it just gets kind of ruined by like Sombra needing the lore to still be a thing, and like it's because musician horse's like soul is in the object and is what allows it to be played that way, and like that's just a stupid lore quirk to make like to because soul trapping is a thing in this story, and like it sucks that like a thematic thing that could have been interesting is ruined by like, but it doesn't make any sense. How did she play an instrument without even knowing it? How could she possibly learn this instrument in seconds? It's not realistic. I have to be able to explain it. Otherwise people would make fun of me for not understanding how this thing makes any sense. It's nitpicky. It's what happens when a writer who prescribes to nitpicky, like obnoxious, all lore has to be thoroughly worked out kind of storytelling, is that you just run over potentially interesting themes in your own story because you have to explain it.
Yeah. I'm meanwhile my brain is still stuck on like the like you shouldn't be helping these people, like the this entire city of people. Why? They're livacious. They do the drugs and the sex. So
yeah.
we should abandon them all to die. Yes, probably.
Yeah.
All right.
thanks Fash Horse. thanks classical liberal horse. She is Sargon of Thunderhead. Anyways, that was a low joke. I'm sorry. I apologize to everyone. But 21 and BJ talk about the fact that they're starting to worry that like all the locals are like, they feel like they've worn out their welcome because all the locals are starting to give them weird looks, and the security forces have started following them around whenever they go from place to place, and just they're starting to get like freezed out from the town, and 21's starting to worry that maybe they should bug out sooner than later, and BJ's like, nah, it's fine, I got this handled, which of course, because it's BJ, it's not handled, it is not fine. Anyways, we fast cut, star wipe to next scene. They head to the robot store, where they have a big fight that I get to basically completely cut out. This is a entire section to show off how cool and badass Rampage is. Since they try to like sneak into the building and Rampage is like, nah, this is boring. I'm just gonna dive in and murder everything, because fuck it. And they get to see the extent of her like regenerative abilities. Like she can basically be like blown up and it won't kill her. Like she can essentially be deatomized and it won't kill her. She'll just regenerate out of it. But they start asking her questions, which starts to piss her off. Like, why does she have red stripes? Or why is she like, why is she weird, and like why is she sometimes talking weird voices, and why can she speak Sebrin and all this other stuff? And she has a freak out about it eventually, mid fight, because she's off her meds again. BJ has to kneecap her to stop her from trying to kill her. Rampage elucidates that she has no memory of who she is or how old she is. They found her in some rubble, like a pair of ghouls found her in some rubble, and they sold her to slavery, and then she eventually busted out. Her name originally used to be Arlost, and she was one of the Crusaders before like the Crusaders were a big thing. Then she took the name Rampage, which was kind of a neat idea. Like, I like the idea that she took the name Rampage because she like wanted to be someone else, and so she found someone that was trying to kill her, and she's like, oh, okay, if you can kill me, you can kill me, but she didn't. So like, okay, I'm going to take your name now and assume your identity. But yeah, she's crazy, she's old, she's impossibly old, she's invincible to basically everything. Even the like laser array of defense systems that turn people into vapor in the core can't kill her. And her sole goal in life now is to die because she can't. And that's Rampage. She is just fucking Deadpool. That's her whole fucking character. She's Deadpool mixed with like Malkavian, basically.
I mean, that's still just describing Deadpool. Like, Malkavians are 90s crazy, and Deadpool typifies that.
Yeah. She is a Rob Liefeld character, in every way. I don't know how, but they get another memory orb that BJ decides to use during this section. Christ, I didn't do a very good job of explaining this section, but it's because the section is so pointless. They have a bunch of the Ministry mayors are watching a tech demo from like a tech bro named Mr. Horse, who runs the local robots company called Robronco. And he shows off basically gray goo. He's like, I have invented nanites that can eat anything and turn it into more of them. And he almost gray goos the entire town and kills it all, and they have to stop it through something. And that just turns out to be complicated corporate espionage by some other company and all sorts of other complicated bullshit that, like, I don't remember nor care about in the slightest. Like, I remember Mr. Horse being a big prominent character, but kind of as a dodge. Like, he's set up as a long-running villain in the story, and then later on in the story, just goes, psych, it was actually this other thing. Because, of course, Golden Blood could be the only true Machiavellian master manipulator within this story.
Yep. all roads lead to Daigotsu Sean Carmen masturbating. Extremely... just getting more and more narrow with my like...
references?
Subcultural references.
Horace is meant to be like the like.
Hey, Sean Carmen, I'm calling you out. I'm sure you're gonna hear this, Sean Carmen. I have no doubt that like the English teacher living somewhere in Middle America who did a lot of writing for the L5R TCG is a big fan of our podcast, but not anymore because I'm calling you out, Sean Carmen. You're a shitty writer. Oh, well, you're actually decent, but you're fucking. The fucking self-inserts, like, why?
Welcome back to the L5R cast. The cast within a cast. Oh, man. But yeah, Horse sucks as a character because he's meant to just be like, I think he's meant to be a criticism of Randian capitalists, not understanding that the other antagonist is a Randian capitalist. It's such a bizarre moment of dissonance, but anyways, they for some reason decided to give more mail out, and they take it to the cake shop that they find in the ruins. It's a cake shop that's been turned into a Ministry of Morale like base and detention center before the war. And this is one of those things that, like, in a better story, this would have been a cool idea, but like, it's just useless because of like the problems with Ministry of Morale. But the Ministry of Morale is, because it's run by Pinkie Pie, all of the like horrible like black bag shit that they do is all referenced in like really cutesy tones. So like they have like political dissenters are written on a chalkboard, but it's like bad people and really really bad people and good people and like how they fit into these categories, and like the dissonance is kind of a good kind of dissonance, but it like again fails because like it requires accepting like a massive character assassination on behalf of Pinkie Pie specifically to accept like this insane premise in the first place. But the idea of like a cheery Gestapo is like a really like unsettling concept, and I kind of like it as an idea. It would be better served in a better story, is I guess what I'm getting at. But they tour through the building that's pretty ruined. They find some people that are trapped in the building. Just as the building decides to collapse on them for narrative convenience, So they save a bunch of horses, and they find out that one the slaver from previous chapters that she like point blank emptied a gun into the air over. It's her again. Her and her daughter were captured by a rapist. But here's the twist. The rapist was one of the former slaves that she brought into slavery. So it's a complex, high energy situation. But they decide to spare the slavers, and then there's a lot of hand wringing over what to do with the rapist. And 21 insists, no, you have to kill him, for justice. And in a better story, the idea of punitive justice versus like restorative justice would have been an interesting point here. But they really just do the thing where it's like, okay, I'm going to count to 10 and run as far as you can, and I'm going to take this gun out and count to 10. And it would be a tense scene if it wasn't artificial, I guess is the point. It's another one of those like cool things from a Western that I like. But she ends up like not shooting him because of course she doesn't. And 21 gets mad at her, and Glory applauds her for not killing people mindlessly. And insists again that she's not an executioner, which is a growing theme in the story. Oh, boy. Cool. So we're getting close to the
end. No, it only makes her wet when it's hot-blooded. There has to be passion, or else
there has to be justification. I can't have a cold murder. Oh, yeah, that is a fucked thing, isn't it? And here's where I got lazy.
Let me guess. I can taste. I have, my third eye is viewing a scene. Inevitably, I'm going to guess. Tell me if I'm wrong. At some point, Blackjack is going to slide somebody a gun and Legmo will pick it up.
God. I mean, no, because the story does that for her. Like, the story...
God damn it.
We're going to get...
What a fucking...
What a cop-out?
What a fucking beta. Like... Somber, you loser. You can't even fash right. Like, learn something from fucking Clint Eastwood, man. Like,
there is an
Dirty Harry would at least have the
balls to give him a gun. A frustrating thing I'm going to get into a lot in this story is that a lot like later villains often are given the opportunity to save themselves from BJ's destruction, and they just so happen to go, nah, I'm just going to try and shoot you anyways. And she's forced to kill them. Like, it's out of her hands at that point.
Oh, no. Yeah. Look what you made me do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just for endless convenience.
Yeah.
Thumb always hard on that utilitarian scale.
Yep. I just had to kill him. I gave him every second chance, and he took a gun on me. I had to shoot him 40 seconds.
Anyway, what happens next?
Yeah, so we're not yelling about this all day. So this is where I got real lazy, and my notes kind of fall apart here after this point. But fuck it, I remember everything that happens at this point anyways. So we cut to the next scene where BJ argues with the incredibly shitty doctor that Glory pushed out of the way to fix her up. Scalpel has been playing like psychologist, I guess, for BJ for the last little while. But since Scalpel's own ethics are incredibly fucked up and skewed, since she's a doctor in a drug den, we get she panders the notion that like, oh yeah, there's no good and evil. There's just people are just people, and like you just have to accept that. And also like, don't do anything to help people is basically the like point, because there's no point in it. Like, and she calls her, is like, aren't you a doctor? Aren't you, like, do no harm? And she's like, within reason. Like, I'm not going to fix up an addict who's going to kill themselves tomorrow, like, is her ethics, which is fucked and terrible. That's a terrible opinion for a doctor to have.
Yeah, kind of a lot.
But it's a doctor written by a somber, so fuck it. And she also just makes the, like Scalpel doesn't even care that, like, anything, like, She like, because like BJ keeps making arguments about like why she saved them and why she didn't kill them, and like Scalpel is kind of effortlessly breaking down that like, oh yeah, well it doesn't matter, like it doesn't matter, like, because the ends don't matter, the means don't matter, it just doesn't matter, like nothing matters, everyone's bad, fuck it, it's the wasteland.
You sure this character's name is Scalpel and not Ataraxia?
Like
he like pure pure, uncut, smooth brain centerism.
So here's the actual exchange.
The fucking drill quote, like, the sage nodded his head and said, "There is no difference between good and bad things. You idiot, you fool, you lummox."
Here's the actual exchange. BJ is, it's a lot of, like, quick conversations between them. So she quit being a slaver, replied Sophia. That has to count for something. She responds, "She lost her gun and her crew. That doesn't mean she quit. First grade fear. She deserves something," I mentioned. "If it wasn't in flank, it doesn't matter," which is a fucked up thing for a doctor to say. "It matters to you, sure, to me, a bit. But to most ponies, it was their own fault getting caught. Hell, most ponies would think it was fair payback to a former slaver. She has a foal." "Well, that's a first in the wastelands," Galpel said with a chuckle. "You know what your problem is?" "Brain damage," BJ responds. "You think all ponies are good people and you want to help them." Which I hate that line of thinking. Like, I hate, it's like, well, like,
how did this person become a doctor? What the fuck is this person doing hogging up space in a clinic?
It's the concept that, like, all cynics were once wide idealists that were, like, eventually woken up to the truth of the world around them. That's, like, a persistent theme.
No fucking wonder Dr. Professor Scientist the Fallen had to shove this idiot aside to treat Blackjack. Like, what? Like, this is the sort of, like, asshole in the, like, that's slowly taking over the American medical profession of, like, "Well, that's a pretty severe, oh, you're hemorrhaging blood pretty quick, but, well, first, let's make sure you can pay for this procedure."
Yeah.
No, this isn't, like, this isn't a demoralized person, this is a sociopath. This is...
Yeah. But. To someone like Somber, there's no difference. Like, sociopathy is caused by, like despair, basically. And it's not just, like, innate. But, anyways, that conversation ends with her being like, "I gotta go find Caprice." And Scalpel's like, "You haven't figured out who Caprice is yet." And cue wacky soundtrack, because no one's gonna fucking tell her. Which gets really rough in this next fucking scene. BJ... goes back to hang out with the bar horse, and the bar horse is like, "Well, you know, Caprice should be back anytime now. You should go wait for her in the room. I'll be there in a second to give you some tender loving." And we actually get, like, a cool scene that's created out of contrived bullshit. So I'll have to walk us through this. We then cut to the next scene in which BJ is kind of weirdly delirious and kind of out of it, which it took me a while to figure out what was actually happening until I realized that she's been, like, massively drugged during this sex scene at some point, and she doesn't realize it. But Caprice, like, goes off. She's like, "Okay, I'm gonna go get something for our next round of fucking, I guess." And while she's sitting there, drugged out of her mind on, it's probably moon dust, honestly, the, like, skeletal horse shows up, and he's like, "Blackjack, you need to take some Fixer," which is, like, the anti-drug drug. It cures, it at least dispels the symptoms, even if it doesn't, like, get rid of the drug in your system. And she's like, "Nah, I'm fine. I'm just on drugs. Whatever. I'm happy. Why does everything have to be, like, miserable with you, Skeleton Horse?" And he's like, and Skeleton Horse is like, "Blackjack, you're going to die. You need to take a Fixer." And she's like, "Oh, come on." And then she's like, "Look around you. Like, this isn't right." And she starts, like, looking around the scene, and she starts noticing things for the first time in the room. And she manages to get the Fixer out of the closet and eat it, and she notices all the knickknacks in the room of this bar horse, and then she notices the reveal that we've been setting up for the entirety of this page. She notices a little framed picture which is an old man and three young ponies, one of which is Bottle Cap, revealing that this bar horse has been Caprice the whole time. Bum bum bum.
I don't care whether Blackjack lives or dies. Like, this is a person who's, like, slept with somebody for, like, 2-3 days and never once thought to ask their name or had, like,
so it,
the faintest, like, curiosity.
Well, it's what it is. It's not even that. It's dumber than that. It's pure sitcom bullshit. She has asked everybody. This is one of the few times she's not even curious. It's just that everyone's being cute about it and doesn't want to tell her.
No, the person she's been having sex with for
including
the past 2 or 3 days.
But she's like, "Oh, well, I don't want to tell you
what." No, like, "Hey, bartender, what is your name?"
Yeah.
Is what I'm saying. Like,
yeah.
B- But before we fuck, can I, what do I even call you?
Yeah. Like, yeah, this scene drives me nuts because it makes, BJ's an idiot, whatever. It's she holds the idiot ball whenever the story needs to, like, make her do that. But that's not my problem with the scene. It makes every other single person in her friend group a sociopathic monster. Because this almost killed her, and no one bothered to tell her who it was. Even though everyone else had their apprehensions about Caprice, because of various reasons, everyone insisted on not telling her. This is incredibly screwed up. This is not, like, this is the problem when you introduce shitty sitcom story plots into your, like, dark, dark fantasy setting. Like, they're incongruous with each other.
I can't be angry on this one. I just don't have it in me. It's just too stupid.
Yeah, you're like, right. It's just you're totally right, but like I can't let go of this point. Like it's one of those points of like, what the fuck was this? This is so screwed up and terrible. Like Caprice makes like a when she comes back into the room and she realizes she's been had. She has a panicked moment where she's like, I wanted to be someone else for a while. I didn't want to be me. And because she's, you know, Caprice is a horrible drug dealer prostitute, so she didn't want to be that person anymore. She also was paranoid that Blackjack is trying to take over the town, and so she's been like kind of setting her up to this point. And BJ clues in that the reason why the bounty hunters knew where she was, and the reason why Deus knew where she was, and all that stuff is because Caprice had been like telling everyone where she is and sold her out, but. BJ has a pretty major breakdown about this, and then, you know, considers beating her to death, and then just like, nah, fuck it, I'm not an executioner, you just live your life, whatever, fuck you. But like, God, I hate, and then the ending closing scene is kind of like the you know, them leaving town with their little counter of horses and a small cart to put their stuff on, and they leave, as they're leaving, yeah, Rampage is like, so have you figured out who Caprice is yet? Because, like, knowingly, because she knows the situation. And she just tells her to shut up. And I hate that scene. I hate that exchange so much because, like Christ, all of her friends are evil. They just insisted on not telling her, like, an incredibly dangerous, like...
Cut to a clip of Spaceballs, Lord Dark Helmet, luminary of our times. I'm surrounded by assholes!
Yeah, like,
I knew it!
Like, the one not good excuse that at least Glory gets is that she's, like, mega jealous of Caprice because she has a crush on BJ. But, like, fucking 21, like, come on. Like, his whole thing is, like, he's the paranoid skeptic. And, like, Rampage is just knows the situation. And... like
I mean, I can see Horace Poole like withholding it because like out of at first just incredulity that like she hadn't figured out the obvious and just not asked this person, like, and not asked the bartender, their bartender patron, like what their name was, and so just thought it was funny and wanted to see how long the game could go on. Like, especially as a being who is like disconnected from the concept of mortality. That's a very Deadpool, like, dead horse, like, is a horse pool, like, kind of thing to do. Like, have you figured it out yet?
Yeah.
21 is just an obstinate asshole. Like, 21 is just an enormous asshole, so I can believe that. And Dr. Professor Scientist is an asshole and a moron.
Yeah.
respectively, so...
yeah.
Sure.
I don't know. I still hate it. I think it's another one of those moments where, like, I guess like our experiences are slightly different, as this is a, like my folk retelling of this is a bit different from reading it in full. But like,
oh, I'm sure I would be frothing at the mouth. I'd be foaming at this point. Like, I would pick up whatever device I was using through this to read it on and throw it across the room.
Yeah,
but like from my distant standpoint, not having to actually wrestle with the actual prose in the moment to moment of it, it is just kind of funny and dumb.
Yeah.
Like it's like. I'm viewing, like, from my standpoint, it is a sitcom scenario, but it's an Always Sunny in Philadelphia scenario. Then, like, it's funny because, it's funny because they're all awful. All of these characters are
You almost died. It's just, I don't know, it's incredibly tone deaf and terrible, is, I guess, my standing point on the issue. But, that's our chapter for the week. It was kind of a long one, but we spent a lot of time yelling about fascism, so, you know, that's bound to happen. Weird, do you have any, like, notes before we do, like, the iTunes and closer? Do you?
Speaking of notes, give us notes. Phi has Discord, that's well advertised. He also has a Twitter.
Yeah, you can find me at Thou Art Phi.
So if you're not going to leave us an iTunes review, please leave us whatever feedback you got.
We need like a fun we need like a fun hashtag, like hashtag I don't know.
Land friendship forgotten.
It's kind of wordy, but I like it. You could just put like our hashtag like fanfic of a fanfic is also pretty good. And just like ask us questions, and we'll do a mailbag at the end of the end of the week as well. I'll have to bully Weird into getting a Twitter as well.
Review, press stars and bells and thumbs ups and all the things, until I was gonna say until next time, but that just occurred to me that means there's going to be a next time. Oh, this has all been a terrible mistake.